This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, December 18th, 2007, from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, the FCC relaxes media consolidation rules to the chagrin of Congress. Israel conducts an air raid on Gaza, killing more than 10 people. And, in light of recent deaths, Canadians call for the end of taser use by police. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice appeared in Iraq today. She stopped first in Kirkuk in the northern Kurdish region before flying to Baghdad. Rice's visit comes at an especially tense time due to Turkish military incursions and shelling along the shared border. The head of the regional government of Iraqi Kurdistan refused to meet with Rice to protest the apparent U.S. acceptance of the Turkish military action. The British government announced today that it will grant amnesty to 19,000 asylum seekers. Thousands more asylum seekers may also receive permission to remain in the UK. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
This amnesty may be contentious. The government refuses to use the word at all. But the Home Office has a backlog of 450,000 cases it wants to clear by the year 2011. Many asylum seekers have been in bureaucratic limbo for 10 years. They're not allowed to work, and so they're condemned to destitution and sometimes arbitrary detention. Around 25,000 asylum seekers, including entire families, are locked up each year while awaiting an immigration decision. This anonymous asylum seeker suffers from depression and anxiety.
It's not easy to be locked up for 3 months, and all you get is people insulting you, people not respecting that you have the right to live, as if what you did by coming to this country to claim asylum, that's a crime.
Campaigners say today's announcement should have been made earlier and saved a lot of unnecessary suffering. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Sri Lankan officials say heavy monsoon showers have driven more than 30,000 people from their homes in the eastern part of the country. Paniya Monikavasagam has the story.
Monsoon-driven rains have forced an estimated 10,000 people into temporary shelters. Another 20,000 have moved in with relatives and friends. A depression over the Bay of Bengal has increased the monsoon rains. The government is providing dry rations and cooked meals to the flood victims. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Colombia's FARC guerrillas have reportedly decided to release three of their political hostages. Cuba's official news agency, Prensa Latina, is reporting that the FARC sent a message of its intent to release Clara Rojas, a former advisor to kidnapped presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt, Rojas' young son, and former Congresswoman Consuelo González. The three will reportedly be released to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Chavez had, until recently, acted as a mediator in the hostage negotiations between the FARC and the Colombian government. Subway workers in Buenos Aires went on strike today, the first work stoppage since Argentina's new president took office last week. Marie Trigona reports.
Argentine subway workers called for the strike to demand higher wages and an increased holiday bonus. Subway delegates organizing independently from the official transportation union voted in favor of the measure in an assembly meeting last night. The strike has paralyzed the city, clogging highways with traffic jams. The official UTA, Transportation Workers Union, rejected the work stoppage, accusing the subway delegates of far-left actions. A group of thugs, allegedly from the UTA, broke up a press conference last night held to announce the protest measure. The thugs attacked journalists and subway delegates, breaking television cameras. Ariel Rochetti said Metrovias, the private company that runs the Buenos Aires subway system, has fired workers in order to break up union organizing activity in the subway.
We have police in our workplace 24 hours a day to intimidate and control the workers. They also installed security cameras in our workplace with the clear objective to control the workers' organizing efforts.
The strike will continue until midnight while workers negotiate with the labor ministry. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
A group of seven Mexican guest workers traveled to Houston yesterday to file a complaint against their employer before the district office of the Department of Labor. Nick Cooper reports.
All of the men who filed the complaint are experienced welders from the port city of Veracruz. They spend hundreds of dollars each to secure H-2B guest worker visas and travel to Mobile, Alabama, after representatives from Bender Shipbuilding and Repair Company contracted their labor. The men say once they arrived in the U.S., the company required them to take an additional test, then told them they were no longer eligible for the jobs they had been contracted to fill. When they petitioned for reimbursement of their expenses, a company representative allegedly responded with insults and had the men followed home by company security. One of the men, Jesus Manzanares, says the H-2B visa leaves workers wide open to exploitation.
We want H-2B visas to not just be for one boss, because it turns us into slaves. It's like before, only more modern. We're the slaves of only one boss. We can't leave and look for work for another company, because if we do that, they deport us.
The workers say that Bender Shipbuilding violated their contracts and subjected them to discriminatory treatment. They're asking the Department of Labor to investigate the company and have filed a formal complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Mobile. The men have also petitioned the Mexican consulate in Houston to help them return to Veracruz. For FSRN, I'm Nick Cooper in Houston.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Today, the Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 to relax its media ownership rules. Specifically, the vote will allow one media organization to own a newspaper and a broadcast outlet in the same city. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin says the vote came after a, quote, exhausting and exhaustive process. But Democratic members of the commission say that dirty politics are at play. And as FSRN's Karen Miller reports from Washington, Congress is threatening to push back.
FCC Chairman Kevin Martin started today's vote by giving the FCC a pat on the back.
Whether it was the extraordinary amount of time that was focused on the details of planning the hearings all across the country, the late nights spent listening to and recording the thousands of oral comments, reviewing the independent studies that we conducted, regardless of what we'll end up saying about the substance of the positions on the items today. I think everyone will appreciate the dedication and hard work that the staff conducted in this thorough process.
But it has been the process that many have found troubling all along. Originally, the new guidelines were to only affect the top 20 broadcast markets and allow the ownership of a major daily newspaper and/or television or radio station by a single media corporation. But in revisions that came just hours before the vote was taken, the guidelines were expanded to include possibly even more cities. Democratic member of the commission, Michael Copps, says it's the wrong way to do things.
I am not the only one disturbed by this illogical scenario. Congress and the American people have done everything but march down here to storm Southwest D.C. and physically shake some sense into us. Everywhere we go, the questions are the same. Why are we rushing to encourage more media merger frenzy when we haven't demonstrated addressed the demonstrated harms caused by previous media merger frenzy?
Another issue that has proven to be a sore spot from the beginning is the impact on minority and women-owned media. Today, the Government Accountability Office released a report highlighting the lack of female and minority-owned broadcast stations. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin says the new guidelines will provide more opportunity, but Michael Copps said the new guidelines will only help a few.
We are told to be content with baby steps to help women and minorities, but the fine print shows that the real beneficiaries will be small businesses owned by white men.
Lawrence Wheatley from the D.C.-based cable show DCTV came to the vote today in opposition to it. He says it's all about who has the most money.
First of all, we're talking about public property, right? I mean, the airwaves and all of that's being commodified. Everything's for sale now. And it's the people with money and money interests that prevail over the masses of folks who are just regular folks.
Despite the vote, the fight is long from over. In Congress, Senators John Kerry and Barack Obama have said they will block funding for the revisions, and Senator Brian Dorgan said he would push, quote, a resolution of disapproval in Congress against the FCC action. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
A compromise of sorts may be on the horizon in Washington. The massive omnibus spending bill is expected to make its way to the Senate floor today, where Republicans hope to attach $40 billion for the war in Iraq. As it currently stands, the bill provides $516 billion to fund domestic programs as well as the war in Afghanistan, but Democrats have been reticent to give the Bush administration money for Iraq. This in part because they hope to force a troop withdrawal, but also because Bush's budget on the domestic side was woefully low in the eyes of many Democrats. But this spending bill does not appear to be much better for Democrats. According to David Ferdoso, a political reporter for the National Review Online, they were forced to drastically reduce their spending requests.
The other thing is that the Democrats had to leave off a lot of the policy riders they wanted. Usually when you do appropriations bills, you attach conditions to the funding, such as that money can or cannot go to groups that perform or fund abortions overseas, that sort of thing. The Democrats had a lot of policy riders they wanted, and they had to drop nearly all of them just because they had to pass an appropriations bill.
Bush has either threatened to veto or vetoed most domestic spending bills that have come in over budget. Steve Ellis, vice president for Taxpayers for Common Sense, says Democrats blew a big chance to push through their spending requests when they didn't test the president's veto threats earlier in the session.
The president actually had hardly any opportunity to veto anything. He made a lot of threats, but the Democrats sent him two bills, the defense bill and the labor, health, and human services spending bill. One got signed, one got vetoed. And so essentially, they never really tried him or dared him to actually use his veto pen. And if they had started doing that back in September, I think we'd be in a much different position right now.
Democrats have trimmed their budgetary requests in the current version, and if GOP senators can attach funding for the Iraq war, Bush is expected to sign the spending bill into law. On the campaign trail in Iowa, Senator Hillary Clinton is undergoing a slight makeover. As the battle for the important primary state intensifies, Clinton seems to be feeling the heat as the rest of the candidates are successfully garnering voter support. Now, her messaging machine is pulling out all the stops. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Des Moines.
At a Senator Clinton event Monday night just outside Iowa City in Coralville, there was one last question of the night.
Yes, young man right there. You can yell and I'll repeat it.
Not speaking into a microphone, he asked why middle-of-the-road people, even many Democrats he knows, don't like her. Clinton's response?
It breaks my heart, but that is true. And that don't like me, although they've never met me. But, you know, I got to tell you that if you've been fighting for the causes you believe in and taking on tough special interests as long as I have, you're going to get beat up.
But that question is a reality that Clinton says she's had to deal with her whole public life. And it's become evident it's one she's continuing to deal with in Iowa. As the caucuses get closer, the race is getting tighter. It's no longer a runaway victory for Clinton. Other Democratic contenders are also appealing to Iowans. Recognizing that, the highly sophisticated Clinton campaign is working double time. Senator Clinton was on all six major TV morning news shows Monday, and the campaign is making it easier for the press to cover her in a positive light. They're sending out flattering sound bites like this one to reporters.
So I'm asking you to stand up for me for one night, and I will stand up for you throughout this campaign. Standing up for our values, our principles, for the kind of change we need to bring the country together, just as I did in New York. And then I will stand up every single day in the White House.
On Sunday, she also launched The Hillary I Know, a website of positive testimonials by friends and constituents. Tuesday, she brought NBA superstar Magic Johnson to Iowa to endorse her. All of these are impressive campaign tactics, hoping to highlight her personal side.
They have been so good about saying positive things about each other.
Jan Taylor was at Monday night's Clinton event.
They haven't been vicious. It hasn't been mudslinging.
She's still undecided, but many Iowans like Taylor scorn at negative campaigning. That might be a reason Clinton's turbo operation has not turned negative. And it might explain the reason she fired one of her top advisors for falsely claiming Barack Obama sold drugs in high school. When asked about Clinton picking it up a notch, Andrea Peirce, a spokesperson for John Edwards, says, Edwards is just trying to focus on kitchen table issues, and we're starting to see it on the ground, continuing to draw large crowds, she says. For Free Speech Radio News in Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As many as 13 Palestinians have been killed in the past 24 hours as Israeli airstrikes against Gaza have escalated. Israel launched the attacks, targeting militants from the Islamic Jihad faction. Islamic Jihad had intensified its own rocket launches into Israel over the past few weeks. In response to the most recent attacks, the militant group has said it will once again begin using suicide bombings inside Israel's borders. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Israeli aircraft raids on Gaza over the past 24 hours claimed the lives of 12 Palestinian resistance fighters of the Islamic Jihad and the ruling Hamas government. Two of them were senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad's military wing. All resistance factions in Gaza vowed to avenge the killings as the Islamic Jihadi group pledged renewal of martyrdom operations, the name used by Palestinian resistance factions in reference to suicide attacks inside Israel. The group also instructed its members to turn off mobile phones to avoid electronic tracking by the Israeli warplanes, which continue to hover over the Hamas-run coastal region. Israeli media is reporting that the Defense Minister Ehud Barak says Israel is bracing for any retaliation by the Palestinian resistance factions and that Israeli military actions will continue. Dr. Muawiya Abu Hassanin, Chief of Emergency Room at the Gaza Health Ministry, describes the situation.
The 12 who were killed arrived at the hospital as dismembered bodies, which means certainly that the shells used were abnormal, apparently flammable or fletchet shells.
Israeli targeted killings of Gaza's fighters come on the heels of two recent major conferences to promote Palestinian-Israeli peace, the December 17th Paris Economic Meeting and the last month's U.S.-hosted Annapolis Summit. Talal Okel, a leading Gaza political analyst, explains the political significance of the recent air raids.
This escalation is apparently intended to send a message to the international community that the Palestinian Authority is unable to live up to its security obligations and control the situation. Therefore, it is not a partner. I think also it is an indication of Israel's genuine intentions to pressure the Palestinians to extract more concessions from the Palestinian negotiator.
In September, Israel declared Gaza a hostile entity and in October imposed large cuts of daily fuel supplies to the region. Israel has been placing Gaza under restricted closure since June as the Israeli army has killed scores of Palestinians, mostly fighters. Israel says its actions on Gaza are meant to stop homemade rockets that Palestinian resistance factions launch onto nearby southern Israeli towns. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
On this seventh annual International Migrants Day, the struggles of undocumented workers all over the world are highlighted. Migrant organizations are using the day to call for changes in policies and to mobilize for human rights. One country where these issues are coming to a head is South Korea, where it is estimated that half of the country's 400,000 migrant workers are unregistered. Most of these migrants work in factories or on farms where they have accepted unfair contracts and working conditions for fear they will be reported. The South Korean government is increasingly targeting migrant workers with harassment and deportation, and only last week, three leaders of the Migrant Workers Trade Union, or MTU, were deported. Yoonji Chang has more on the issue.
Migrant workers are under increasing pressure in South Korea. Only last Friday, three leaders of the Migrant Workers Trade Union were deported abruptly. Kim Dae-kwon, the Secretary General of Korean NGO Friends of Asia, was surprised and angered by the speed and violence of the deportation.
We thought the possibility of deportation was about 50%. We had filed a protest against their detention and forced deportation order to the Ministry of Justice about 10 days ago, which was rejected. So there was no legal barrier. But because the National Human Rights Commission of Korea hadn't made a decision, we didn't believe the immigration office would actually deport them so abruptly and mercilessly.
The three were the top leaders of the Migrant Workers Trade Union, MTU. MTU members and various Korean NGOs had begun a sit-down strike outside the detention center to press for their release. But according to Raju and Gajman, when the officials tried to take them out of the center, they found MTU members and their supporters were waiting at the main gate. So they went to the backyard of the detention center, cut through the wire fence, and forced the detainees to leave through the hall. They were deported from Incheon Airport at 8:40 a.m., and five officials even flew with the union leaders to Nepal. Dorna, who is now acting president of the Migrant Workers Union, is also from Nepal. He says when he came to Korea 14 years ago, people treated him well and were not hostile to migrant workers.
When I first came to Korea, it was very nice. Korean people were nice to me. Actually, the Korean people had no special attitude or concept about migrant workers. Since the Korean economy slowed down in 1997 with the IMF crisis, I have faced some discrimination. And after the employment permit system took effect in 2003, we migrant workers have faced increasingly severe suppression, discrimination, unspeakable mistreatment. We were often even beaten by Koreans.
The employment permit system divided the migrant workers into two groups. About half have a permit to live and work in Korea for 3 years, though without the right to change jobs. And then there are an estimated 200,000 who have no permit or whose permits have expired, leaving them in the category of unregistered workers. And if a new revision of immigration law passes the Congress, migrant workers will have to register biometric information, including fingerprints, with the state. Immigration officials will be given the power to crack down on foreigners in factories, on the street, or in their homes without a warrant. And refugees participating in political activities can be stripped of their refugee status. Labor activist Lee Jung-won says, deporting the three leaders is only part of the whole process of a crossing migrant workers' movement. She believes the government's unexpectedly harsh repression of the MTU is in response to recent political activity by the union, which participated in last summer's demonstrations against the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement.
This movement developed links not just with religious groups, but with various social movements like the Korean labor movement and student movement. The Ministry of Justice was very uncomfortable with the political aspect of the migrant workers' movement, so it has tried to crush the movement by getting rid of top leaders.
Some Koreans are hostile to migrant workers, especially unregistered workers. There are many internet communities where people blame increasing numbers of migrants for unemployment and crime. Some go as far as condemning human rights organizations and religious organizations for helping unregistered migrants. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eunji Kang in Seoul.
Tasers are usually intended to temporarily stun people who pose a threat to police, other citizens, or themselves, but sometimes the results are deadly. By some counts, more than 200 deaths in the United States have been linked to tasers. Since 2003, the Canadian death count is 16. In October alone, two highly publicized taser deaths have occurred in Canada, one of a Polish national in the Vancouver airport, another of a 38-year-old Montreal resident who was tased 5 times during an arrest and later died of multiple heart attacks. In response, communities across Canada are calling for an end to the use of the weapons. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
Around 200 people marched to demand justice in the case of Guillaume Registre, a 38-year-old man of Haitian origin who died 4 days after being tasered 6 times during an arrest by the Montreal police. Montreal police officers stopped Registre on October 14th due to a suspicion of drunk driving. The police claim Registre was tasered because he showed signs of aggressive behavior. However, His sister, Francine Registre, described him as a peaceful and soft person who didn't have any history of being aggressive. Registre died in the hospital 4 days after being tasered during his arrest. Now, 2 months later, his family has still not had access to the police report, so many details of the incident remain in question. Registre's father, Augustin François, was among those taking part in Saturday's demonstration in the Saint-Michel area of Montreal.
Don't use these kinds of weapons to kill people. This weapon that they're using kills people. We don't even kill animals with this.
Kilem Registre was tasered on October 14th, the same day as Robert Jakanski, a 40-year-old Polish immigrant who died immediately after being tasered by Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers at the Vancouver International Airport. That incident was also captured on video and posted on the internet, prompting a coast-to-coast outcry against tasers. Many community organizations across Canada are now starting to call into question the safety of taser guns. Sophie Senecal is with the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality.
We have seen that people who have been tased or who have died from tasers following electric shocks are often people with heart problems or people who have consumed drugs. But despite this, and even after the recommendations of the RCMP this week, they continue to say that it's fine to use tasers in cases where people are on drugs or have heart problems.
On December 12th, the Commission for Public Complaints against the RCMP submitted a report on taser use to the Minister of Public Safety, Stockwell Day. The commission acknowledges that taser use has expanded to include subduing resistant subjects who do not pose a threat of grievous bodily harm or death, and refers to this expanded and less restrictive use of the weapon as usage creep. The report also indicates that the taser has been used outside of its stated objectives during the last 6 years. The report outlines a 10-point guideline which RCMP officers should follow while using taser guns. One of the recommendations of the report states that the RCMP should immediately redesign the taser training its members receive to reflect the classification of the device as an impact weapon, rather than an intermediate device such as pepper spray. The final recommendation of the report also states that the RCMP should be engaged in taser-related research looking at the medical, legal, and social aspects of the weapon's use, particularly looking at the connections between taser use, excited delirium, and the possibility of death. Evan Senilus, the cousin of Kilem Registre, reacted to this report.
It's like a revolver as well. It's a weapon, which is very dangerous and very lethal, and you have to know when and how to use it. I can't say the weapon itself is dangerous, but it's the person who's using it. An example is the case of Kilem. To use 6 discharges against someone, the problem isn't the weapon anymore, but it's the person who's using it. So you really have to train people, and if people aren't able to train themselves, then we just have to abolish the weapon, because it's getting ridiculous. People think it's a toy.
On the day that Registre was tasered, a group of politicians and community leaders in Montreal formed an anti-taser coalition. Several Canadian municipalities have put forward motions to ban the weapon. Meanwhile, the Registre family plans to push for an independent inquiry into the death of Kilem. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal, Canada.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.